Okay, thank you. I'll begin. I'll try to make this general for the pilots, and then I'm going to begin with by reviewing some quick things that we talked about last time. I gave a lecture in February about crowd measurements, so I'm going to review that quickly in case some people I know, like Mark, hasn't seen this. To bring you up to speed, so a few people that are really familiar with this, I apologize that the first couple slides will be somewhat redundant. So what I want to talk about today is a 40 scanning spectrometer probe, which is on the left wing of the King Air 200 aircraft, research aircraft. So this is one of the instruments that are on the research aircraft. And it's very important for making crowd microphysics measurements. It looks at particles normally from 3 to 47 microns in size. So these are cloud droplet particles, not precipitation and not aerosols. So these are the crowd particles. The one thing that will be different this time as opposed to the last one I gave, the previous one I focused on just the FSSP and talked about that. This one is in, some people refer to it SPP 100. It's basically an FSSP with the single processing package upgrade. Okay, so it has the same optics as an FSSP, but it's a newer version with newer single processing. And that makes some difference, and it gives us increased capabilities with this instrument. So some of the stuff I talked about last time was what I'm more familiar with, which is the standard old FSSP. But this one, we'll talk about what the differences are. So I'm going to try to highlight some of the differences between it. The thing that is not different is the optical path. So SPP or FSSP have the same optics in it. So, FFSP is for scattering spectrometer probe. Okay, so that's what it stands for. And so you might, a lot of times I refer to this instrument as an FSSP. Some people refer to it as SPP, which stands for single processing package. And so an SPP 100 is an FSSP 100 with the new electronics in it. So it might get confusing sometimes when people refer to different instruments. And I guess the standard of the community is to refer to it as an SPP. But that's the difference. So think of them at this level, don't worry about the difference. Okay, the optics in here, these are the two arms that you see in a previous picture. And the magic, heart of the instrument is a helium neon laser in here that shoots a beam across. And that's what we use to detect the cloud particles. So this laser beam is what we use to detect it. It hits the particles here, and they scatter light into the optics, which goes back into a single processor unit to detect the scatter light signal. They have a dump spot here, so it doesn't look at forward scattering just that goes through here, but it looks at what's scattered off at the angle. So here I have a laser beam I could shine on the wall here. If you go and you put something, what happened? Why didn't it do it? Did it shut it off? Oh.
Time.
Oh, that's not supposed to do that. Okay, if you shoot a laser beam, you put something in front of it, it blocks it. That's really not what we're doing. We're just scattering the light off of it. So it goes off in a little bit of a different direction. And it's what we look for. So that's the main idea, is that we have that. We have a beam splitter. We know what the laser is to begin with. We know what happens when we have some scattered light to go. There's a couple of things that I'll get into in more detail. You have just a certain part of this beam that's within the depth of field, they call it. So things that are real close here won't be detected. Things far away won't. So it has to be right in this magical spot right in the middle where we can measure particles. Questions? Make sure you interrupt any time if you have any question.
After all, maybe different particles, maybe solid or liquid.
This instrument assumes that there are spherical cloud droplets, spherical water particles. That's the assumption in the instrument. And if you go and you measure in cirrus clouds where you have ice, that assumption is not valid and the data is not valid. Okay, so it's for measuring spherical water droplets, and all the cloud droplets are spherical because they're not that big. Okay, so I talked about that little magic spot in the middle, and that is referred to as the sample volume of the instrument. So we want to know what that sample volume is, because what we're going to do is we're going to count this instrument. When it goes past the laser beam, it sees one droplet at a time. So a droplet goes through there. And when you're flying this instrument, you know, you're flying through the air. So it keeps getting these droplets that go through that laser beam. And we'll count the number of these droplets that hit the laser beam. But we want to know over what volume of space that we're counting these. So we're going to fry this instrument, and we want to sample a very small volume. And so that's the trick to knowing the concentration. Are we counting over a small volume or a large volume? So one thing that's important that goes into this, here's a sample volume equation. It has basically four terms in it. One of them is the speed of the aircraft, and scientists tend to measure that in meters per second as opposed to knots. But you have the speed of the aircraft, which controls this direction, controls the flow of air as you move along with the aircraft. And so one thing is we want to measure that. So we need to measure the aircraft speed very accurately. The other thing that comes in here is the depth of field. So it's along this laser beam. How big of a section of that laser beam are we measuring over? So that's what this is, the depth of field from here to there. And the other parameter, so a volume is three dimensions, is the beam diameter, which is right along here. And if you think about it, this beam diameter, as the air flows, you basically keep moving this beam diameter along. And there's one correction factor here, because we don't see quite on the edges of the beam. So particles, if they're just on the edge of the laser beam, they won't be in there long enough for us to size them, because it takes some time to do that. Okay, so we need three different dimensions to get our volume. And one of them is the aircraft speed. Yes?
The true airspeed, aircraft true airspeed, did you mean the speed of air subtract from the front wind speed?
It's not the wind speed, it's how fast the aircraft is moving through the air.
Sometimes you have to face
but it's relative to that wind. It's not.
Yes, I think it's equations to make the equation about the core speed or the wind and the aircraft speed. We have aircraft speed here.
Yes.
And we have
on your face, in the wind, you have another speed.
A headwind across you. You need.
If you have that, that would.
It's the speed of the air.
It's the speed of the air.
It's not ground speed. It's not aircraft speed. No. It's not indicated speed.
No.
It's the true speed of the air.
Yeah. But the object is.
And it's corrected for pressure and temperature.
Yes.
It's corrected.
Very good.
It's the speed of the air.
It's the speed of the air.
The speed of the airplane with
no.
respect to the ground or the wind.
It's the airflow.
It's the air actually going through the probe. And the key to that, now that I started talking, is look how small those numbers really are.
Yep.
The beam diameter is 0.2 millimeters, and the depth of field is under 3 millimeters. So this is a bright light focused almost to a spot. And you count the drops that go through. And yes, it sees ice, but ice is 1 or 10 or 1,000 per liter. And this is measuring hundreds per cubic centimeter. So yes, an ice crystal will go through and act like a mirror, and it could be, you can see when you're going through ice.
Yeah, it will detect ice, but you don't know exactly what you're...
So, okay.
But yes, and I'll get to the numbers later on, which are important. So the other thing I just mentioned is the effective fraction. Basically, you don't see particles go through there very quickly, and you don't have time to size particles here. If they come through here, you detect it. Ooh, something came through there, but the electronics are not fast enough to size them. So in this area, we can size them, which are total counts. In this area, we can both size and detect them, which are your total strobes. So if you see a particle, it's a strobe. If you can see it and size it, it's a count. So we correct for that with this effective diameter. So that's in there. Okay, so, and to come up with that effective diameter, it's a ratio of the, right here is the ratio value of total counts to total strobes. It's going to be between 0 and 1. So I went this time, and we want to see what that value is. I took measurements from our January 10th flight. This is from the second one. So we went out. This is actually the lightning strike flight. Took the measurements, all the measurements on that flight. You can look at particular areas. It gives you basically the same answer. And looked at what this ratio is. And previous time, I showed you measurements from our citation. So this time, I'm showing you measurements from the aircraft. Theoretically, it should be about 0.62. Kind of what an interest in here is what a fall off. But you basically have this. This is the total number of strobes per second. So getting back to what Terry is saying, we're seeing 2,000 particles per second with this probe. So even in this little razor beam, there's a lot of particles in there that we'll see when you fly through a cloud. But so that's the razor beam fraction that we use to correct that to get the sample volume correction. And measurements from our aircraft. The other correction we do to the aircraft is a coincidence and dead time correction. It corrects for the fact that one thing I said is these particles go through the razor beam one at a time. Well, if you get a big cloud with a lot of particles, they go through actually two at a time. You can just think of this many more particles. Think of it like a highway with multiple lanes. Typically one car be going through a gate or something, but if you have more, you can get two or three particles sometimes going through there. So we can correct for that. Then there's also a a dead time correction in the fact that if you size a particle, it takes a little while to size that one before you can come and size the next one. And then there's a little bit of delay between when you reset from sizing one particle to reset sizing the other particle. So I've used this correction factor before, but it's basically for the FSSP, and I'm not 100% sure what we should be using for the SPP. In the fact that it has new electronics, so I'm wondering if it should be different or not. So for now, I didn't put anything in there for that correction. It's about a 10 to 20% correction at very high concentrations. So it's not a major thing. And I will send an email to a couple people I know in the community and ask them what the latest is, because I could not find it in the manuals. But that's one question I have, is what we should be doing for this correction.
Well, send it to DMT.
I sent it to DMT. I got some of their this stuff. I'll probably talk to Daryl Baumgartner and ask him to what we should do, what he does. So that's the corrections we do. Next, we want to calibrate for the size of the particles that we go through here. So we want to know how accurate we will count the particles. If we count them and we know the volume, we know the number of particles. And this instrument is very good at doing that. The next thing is we want to make sure we know what the size in particles are. So, you know, if we come out to the airplane sometimes, you know, you see a scientist walking around the aircraft doing things. We're checking out, we're checking the instruments, making sure that we know how well they're working, running calibrations and calibration checks on the aircraft. So this is Brad doing a calibration check on the FSSP. So we take, in here we have very precise beads. These are like dust particles of one type that we know about, and we know their size. So they manufacture these, they tell us, okay, these are 15 micrometer beads, or
fine,
these,
fine,
yeah, fine particles, and you put them, there's basically a dust, you put them in the bottom of this, shoot some air through there, and it goes through the instrument.
Okay, what is the speed now?
Hmm?
Through air speed now, dust, what is dust now?
We don't care what the speed is, because we're not calibrating the number, we're just calibrating the size.
What about the volume?
The sample volume?
Yeah.
We'll know from the other calculations. But when we calibrate it, we don't care if we have 100 per cubic centimeter or 300, so we don't need to know the speed. But this will basically, you know, shoot some jets of a jet of air and give it a velocity through that probe. So it basically pushes the particles through the probe.
At the same limit, about 100?
Probably not, it's probably less. So there's a question of what that speed is, but my feeling is it doesn't matter if it's 50 meters per second, 100 meters per second.
Most of the instruments, it depends about
The number of particles per cubic centimeter, number per volume, okay? But to get the size, you don't need the airspeed. You have a particle in your laser beam, it's there, and at one time you're sampling that, okay? It's gonna, and you measure it just when it's in that the center of the beam. Actually, when you get the beam, it goes through there, and you wait until you get the peak. So it's in the middle, okay? And you just take a snapshot in time.
Okay,
So it doesn't matter how fast it's going in through there, as long as it's in the beam long enough to be sized. Okay, you just want to know if it's a 15 micron or a 20 micron. It's the size. So there's two different things. It's the volume that we measure, and that gives you the concentration, and also the size. And because if you want to know how accurate you know the concentration, you need to know how accurate you know the sample volume. So that's one thing, and we generally don't calibrate for that. You could come up with an uncertainty by knowing what the uncertainty in the airspeed is and the uncertainty in the volumes. But what's more important in general is to know the size of the particle, and that's what this calibration does.
Size.
Is the size. Nothing with the concentration.
Droplets or aerosol?
No, these are droplets. These are 15 microns. But what we use, to calibrate is polystyrene beads. So
what about the aerosols? Would determine or find any solution to calculate the size of?
If there, there could be 15 micron aerosols, but there's so few.
You know that, but in the air, when you go to the air, how can you?
I'll show you in the next one.
Yeah.
Oops. Well, I'll go ahead once. If we put, this is some data from putting beads through there. And so this is channel number here. Think of this as different sizes. So this is like 3 microns down here. It goes up to 50 microns. This is actually 20 channels, but each one of these channels is a different size. Okay?
Yeah.
So when we go and we have a channel, I'm kind of skipping around here. And so you have so many particles that fall within a channel, which is between like 3 microns and 5 microns. If it says it's in there, it gets put in a channel. Okay.
Automatically,
yes. So that, and so I'll show you how that happens in the previous. But when we calibrate it, what we do is we put beads of one size through there, and it swamps the instrument. I mean, it swamps the natural background. So if there's a few 15 micron particles, which is not very many, we'll have hundreds or thousands more of what we put into it. So it doesn't matter. And there's not many 15 micron particles.
Is that channel number on the bottom? I'm confused. What are those numbers?
Yeah, these are channel numbers. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Just those
tick
marks and that are confusing.
Yeah, this is 9, so
okay.
It goes from 8.5 to 9.5.
And you're on scale 0. So
yes. Yeah. And I only show on this one, it actually goes up to 20 channels.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that's different with the SPP version, is you can. On the other one, you're limited to 15 channels. On here, it's selectable by the instrument. You can either have 10, 20, or 40 channels with the SPP version. And the way we're running it on a standard 20 channels. So we split the size interval into different channel interval. You know, we can say, okay, we're going to, you know, start from one thing here and one here. How many bins, how many channels do we want to put the bucket into? You can make it smaller, get more channels, and you get smaller number of particles, small and total counts in any one of them channels. And we're running at 20 channels.
And they're evenly distributed? And
no.
Okay.
And I'll tell you about that.
How the diameter of aerosol is interacting with wind.
Hmm?
That asking it?
Is asking, is it found by the interaction between the bead diameter and wavelength?
Yes. Okay, so I'll talk about that in this one. Is the way, if you have a, we want to know how we get the size of the drop of the particle. And if you have a particle of a certain size, say 10 microns, there's a scattering intensity. So if you have a laser beam and you have a detector that looks off at the side, the amount of light that you see will increase by the size of the particle. And it's really not just the size of the particle, but it's the size of the particle relative to the wavelength of the laser beam. Okay? So we have a 670 nanometer laser. So bigger particles relative to that size will scatter more light. So you get out here at 50 microns, you're scattering a lot. Down here at 1 or 2, you're scattering very little. This is a log scale also, so there's factors of 10 difference here. Okay. But the other tricky part is that up here, it's a linear function. Okay. However, down here, you get these me scattering bumps, they call them. Which means if you zoom in on here, is that for one, this is what you measure. So for one scattering intensity, it could be different size particles. For this case, it could be three different particles. And you don't know which one of them three it is. So that hopefully you put it into a bin. If all three of them fall within one bin, it's no problem. But it could possibly be that it falls in two different bins. And so then it's kind of arbitrary where you put it. The other thing that it depends upon is there's two of them here. These are basically the beads or the dash lines here, and then you got water. Okay, so the scatter intensity depends not only on the size, but also the material. Okay, so that's why if we want to size accurately, we want to know that what the material is. And we're pretty lucky because we deal with water droplets, and water is all the same material. So, but the problem becomes in the fact that we calibrate with beads, that's a different material. So we calibrate with one material, we don't calibrate with water beads, we calibrate with these kind of like dust particles. And they have a little bit different scattering. And by theory, you can refer from one to the other. We know how one scatters, we know how the other one is. As long as you know what the materials are, you can theoretically predict that and verify it in the lab. So that's very well known. But that's how we get the sizes. And that's what the detector sees.
What's the person of mistake? When we determine the particle size, and we have three or two points.
Yes.
We must have some relative mistakes.
Yes.
How much?
Well, that's what happens when we size them. And the if you really want to be smart about it, what you would do is you would set up your bins, and if you really want to do a super good job, what you can do is you got 40 channels, and this goes back to Terry's question. You could set them channels so you could have a whole bunch of channels down in the lower sizes where you have this me scattering thing. So you would skew all of them down there.
And we can minimize, but we can.
No, you can't eliminate. But then you would have to reprocess them and basically put these into one bin because you physically.
Sure.
I'm not going to know the difference.
What really we do it? I grew up with the FSSP, And it was 15 channels, and I say that that's enough.
No.
And 0 to 45, I mean, was the scale, and it still is 45 microns, right? Or it goes to 47.
Yeah.
But channel 1 goes from, like, 1, 2, and 3 microns. So you can see that you just draw an intensity for 1, 2, 3. And then 4, 5, 6, you got that. And then 7, 8, 9. And your first three channels takes care of all three of those bumps.
Yeah.
And then the important thing is you're mostly interested in cloud drops bigger than 10 microns anyways.
So you're,
and your liquid water is in the bigger drops. And then it's linear. So we're kind of belaboring, you know, looking at a microscope, something that I almost consider is in the noise. And this actually tells me, don't run it in that channel as an aerosol probe.
Yeah, I mean,
just don't do, you know, so
it's really a cloud probe, and like you say, this stuff down here is going to make no difference to your liquid water.
Very little, and we can approximate it, and it's good enough.
And this is what you're interested in?
Yes.
And you're interested in droplets to see where the peaks are up here? It's not a big deal.
So let's not run it on any other channel than 0. Again.
Yep.
Or we used to do 2 to 30, and that was okay. But 3 to 45 is more important.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what we should, what it's for is measuring crowds. The crowds that are really of importance are up here. It's a fine.
So in this case, we have re-measured the lethal particles, relatively lethal, with big mistakes, the bigger mistakes, then we can measure the bigger particles.
Right, yeah. But what's the mistake? It's still down here. I'd say it doesn't matter. It's either in 1 or 2. It doesn't matter.
If 2 is not precise, then.
Right.
Yeah.
No,
so, like you said,
it doesn't matter one side or two sides.
Yeah.
No. What's really important is up here. So, but. So anyway, we go through, we put the beads through here, we see where the peaks are in the particles, so we know what the sizes are. And so the next one is a list of tables. Please don't try to look at all these numbers. But I have dates here. We have dates of when we've done calibration checks, so when we have run these particles through the instrument. I pick out the times when they go through there. It's only a couple seconds or half a second sometimes because we just shoot these particles through very quickly and we don't need 10 seconds of data. You know, we just need to see where them peaks are. And that way you don't waste a lot of particles, a lot of dust particles. So we visually see which channel it peaks in because that's easy for us to see. And then to get the indication of where they peak, we look at the peak and what's the one below and one above it. So you see it peaks here, but it's a few more counts here than here, so it's a little bit higher. So we'll call that a channel number.
Is that shouldering the result of my scattering on either side?
Yeah, it's just random. I mean, sometimes you get them in there and they're not quite in.
Distribution now would suggest that where the peak is on either side would be the error or a suggestion of the error in the sizing.
Yeah, there is some, but, you know, and when you put them particles in there, it's how you aspirate them, and there's a lot of things that can happen. So, you know, just think it should be a normally distributed Gaussian distributed peak, but don't worry that you're getting particles out. We just put them in there, we know where the peak is in the particles.
The beads lumped together.
Yes.
It's a high concentration using this high pressure gun. You have to be careful. They don't shoot the airstream right through, do they? Because sometimes because you get measurements from the aerosol gun.
Yeah, and I think we use clean. So that's the other thing we could try. I mean, just shoot the gun. But I don't think we see anything when we.
Or even something with light. A compressed gas cylinder is not my favorite for that.
No, what I like to do on this is I actually like to just put a vacuum or something on the back end. And I tried that here, actually in December, is we tried both methods. And I actually do that. We have a vacuum that you just put on the back end, and you just put your dust in front of it and pull it through there.
Just better not stop calling it dust.
Okay.
No, they're glass beads.
Glass beads.
And it confuses them. If they're not dust, they are finely tuned glass beads of no. size. They look like sand. They do, but it's the glass
dust.
Beads.
It's glass beads. So anyway, we look and see how many counts we get, or an average count over a time interval, at the peak, before the peak, after the peak, what mode we're doing it in, like you say, just use mode zero. What size grass beads we put in there. So 15, 20, 15, 14, we have a couple different sizes that we like, but we kind of standardize now on just doing a 15 and 30 micron. Beads is what I like to do. 30 microns are probably the best. So this is the bead size, and then I have the water equivalent size. So this is the size, if you look at the scattering, and if you put these grass beads in there, you have this one scattering size. And so this is the water size that would scatter the same amount of light. Okay. This has a high index of refraction, so it scatters more light. So if we put in here 30 micron beads, it's about a 24 micron particle that we're calibrating against for water. And so I like the 30 microns because we're interested in 24 micron, what's there. That gives you a lot of liquid water. Not so much interesting down here because that weir doesn't contribute to the liquid water. So when I went through now, I took one of the 30 micron tests that we did, I think this one, I took that peak and ran it through my code to figure out where the channels line up based on that calibration. And so this is the water equivalent channel, or the size. This is the average channel. So this is based off of these peaks. It's a little bit larger than 6. And then if you go and you look at the standard channel things in the manual of where do you want to set these up, of if you have a standard configuration that they try to match it to, this is what you should get. So if you put this size beads in here, 20 micron, it should peak right there, assuming everything is working right. So what you want to take away from this is the fact that for this instrument, it's a little bit less than where the standard ones are. 1.5 to 2 channels less. Okay. And this one is the WMI probe with this serial number. This is for the NRL probe. And you see on this one, the average channel size is quite a bit more than the standard channels. Okay. So if you put in particles, it's peaking a lot higher than where it should be. So these two instruments will measure differently going through the same environment. The way to get them to measure the same is to apply the calibration and bring them together. Okay, we have a standard, we calibrate against that standard, and then we move them there. So, and the other thing to take away from it is the NRL one is quite a bit different. And it's so, this is really so different that there's something wrong with the instrument, in my opinion. So we sent this one back. This one, I don't like to see it more than a channel roll. So this one is not so bad, but it's to the point where we might might want to think about having this one checked out too. Because it should be within the channel, is my opinion. But no matter what they are, we can still use the data. We just apply the calibrations. But this makes a difference, because if you move it up a whole one or two channels, and it's not just at the lower channels, it's actually shifting everything up a channel. So you're really increasing things by, you know, 3 or 4 microns. And so then my code also looks at this, and it doesn't even redistribute the, and it should, I should correct that, it's not my code, it's Dale Baumgartner's code, so I don't want to take the credit or the blame for this. But we, I got his code, we ran it through on these one channels using the theory for the scattering of the part of the grass beads, and get a very accurate measurement. And the other thing we can do that's really good about this, you can take away, is it doesn't change that much. That's the main thing for the project, is you want to be consistent. How much does it change from 1 week to another? And it doesn't. Except there's some, yeah, these channels are going to be the same all the time. But here, it's 4.1, 3.9, you know, a couple tenths of a channel. That's not much. If you go and all of a sudden, you know, you see that it's 2 channels different or 3 channels different, then something happened to your instrument. And that's why I don't like this a lot. So consistency is important, and also how close you can get. But there's lots of reasons why you would be off by that. So that's, we could take this, come up with the size intervals, and they're approximately even redistributed, but not exactly. Okay. I'm going to try to hurry up here, but so that's all the data. February 3rd was when I gave the previous lecture. I gave an assignment, and I know Terry looked at the data. So I'm going to present the results. Sorry, this should be crossed out. Cross that out. We're on March 9th. I want to compare now. We got the data from the probe, and you understand what the probe is. I'm going to compare 2 different processing streams or methods. So we got the real-time playback method of calculating the data, and we got my post-process method. And here's a summary of what they are. Here's your beam diameters. I'll start here, and your depth of field. So you, like Terry was pointing out, these are small, you know, 0.2 microns, 2.3 microns. These were measured by Dennis when he was here in December. So we did measure this. We have these measurements. I put these in both of the processing routines. So I got my method and the playback method. So they both have these numbers in there. I refer to one as kind of real time because you get it in real time on the aircraft, and the other one is post-process where you do it after the fact. They both have a beam fraction correction in it. There's no coincidence correction in the playback method. I did not put any in here because I'm not sure exactly what to put in at this point. And they both can be have a bead size calibration applied to them. And for what I'm going to do now is I'm going to compare actually the concentrations. So the bead size is not so important for the, it's not important at all for the concentrations. In 2 weeks, I'll give a lecture where we talk about liquid water, where the concentration is important, where the bead size calibration is important. But start at the simplest things first. Okay, questions? So, I know Terry did this. He showed me this data, and he goes, "Dave, what's up with this? This is." So Terry did this. So I shouldn't jump ahead of myself. What I have plotted here is the total droplet concentration. So it's all the channels. So you sum up all the number of particles in all the channels. So it's the total number that you count from this probe. And what I plotted is the Oh shoot, I did it backwards. It's my method versus the SPP concentration from the M300. So this is coming from the M300. This is coming from my data processing. And I guess I kind of gave it away, but the question asked, is this reasonable? And it's not, because you got such a scatter in these plots. It's the same data. So I'll give Terry an A for doing this. Anybody else try to do this? No? Okay, everybody else don't get a grade, I guess. I can show you some of that, but I want to finish this up. I show you one part of liquid water if you want at the end. So this is no good. So I looked at it, and there was a problem. So I looked at it, and there was a problem in the bean size correction in my processing, because of the documentation I got from DMT was incorrect. So it's nice to have documentation. It's even better to have correct documentation. So I figured out what was wrong with that. Reprocessed it. And now I'll ask Terry, is this more reasonable?
Yes.
Is it reasonable enough?
Well, that's what it should look like. I'd like to, so the slope is 1.7. I'd like to see the 1-to-1 line.
Yes. And
it's, it's
so why? So Terry, correctly assume that now we got good scatter, but the unreasonable part about this is the slope. It should be 1-to-1. And I actually did this last night, and I spent a couple hours trying to figure out why it's not 1-to-1. And because it has to do something with the sample volume, because if there's such a good correlation, we have to be using a different sample volume that would affect all the measurements. So at the end, for the Saudis, for Terry, anybody wants to, I have all the data for this flight, and I challenge you, give you an assignment, try to tell me what's going on here, of why this is not 1-to-1. Because it basically should be the same processing, same methodology, and you should come up with the same answer.
Unless it's maybe the real time isn't corrected for the coincidence, or are you sure in real time it's total counts by total strobes? That's the quick one.
Yeah, it does put a beam fraction correction in there. At least there's a parameter. This beam fraction correction, my understanding, looking at the tables, is that in the concentrations in the tables, there is a parameter that is the beam fraction parameter or whatever. It goes into the calculation. I don't know if it's applied, but it's being calculated and fed into the concentration thing. So I could try it without the beam fraction correction.
Or is activity still in there? Is that what they call the activity?
No, the activity is to calculate the coincidence and dead time correction. But we do calculate an activity, but it's not, that would go into the coincidence correction.
I'm sure that that's it. I mean, having an offset could easily be reasonable. It still is reasonable. I'm glad we don't have a scatter, but to have that slope and deviating consistent at the higher, I don't know.
Yeah, so something to think about. And we can dive into the data.
Oh, this doesn't make sense, because your correction, I can't see that the real time would have a higher concentration.
I reverse the axes. This is the M300, and this is mine.
Oh, okay.
So I apologize. I did this one backwards.
Okay,
this one should have been down here. So.
So then it's in the right direction.
It is in the right direction. If you want to put in.
No, this all could be real, and it probably is then that the real time, although it calculates the activity, doesn't correct for it.
I could check that by actually not putting the correction in my code. I did not put any coincidence correction in here, but I put a beam fraction correction. So
if you didn't put a coincidence correction in your Linux processing, then would that maybe explain the other passing?
No, if I put coincidence correction in here, it's about a factor, it's a slope of 2.1. So if I add coincidence, it correctly increases the slope. Okay, but I do have the beam fraction correction in here. So that's easy to test, so that's a good project for anybody who wants to help me out with that. Okay, Terry wants to see some liquid water, but the one thing I want to make a point out to the people I want to talk about this, there's limitations to the playback method, and I've listed them here. To testing these things, I can't look at the code, so like Terry is asking me, well, is it in there? I don't know because I can't look at SEA's code to see if they actually apply it.
I thought everything is in there.
Not the C code, not the actual, I can look at, I know what the function is, but actually what they're doing in that function, I don't know. It's also limited to test the data. I can do it my code, I can generate some data and just a data file and send it into the system. Maybe you could do that with the binary data files that SEA generates, but it would be very hard to generate some data to test. It's difficult to work with the formula tables, time consuming relative to other methods. The other thing I don't like about the playback is you're limited to current and past values. I have process routines for the King probe and for the CCN counter where I use values ahead in time in the process routine. And it's somewhat difficult to automate. So if people want to choose the method, I think the M300 is great for acquisition, but not so much for data processing. And that's basically the conclusion of the talk. We got some disagreement, we can resolve it. I can give you all the data files if you want to look at them. Also, if you just want to look at the data files and that, we have ASCII files from the playback method for my processing. I have them on my disk. You can put them in Excel, plot them up. So we have all the data from this flight if you want to look at this in more detail. And I'll close by the last one of a liquid water. And this is a prelude to the next talk I'll give specifically on liquid water. The difference between the playback method and my calculated liquid water. Now we're talking quite a bit of difference of a 3.5 slope. So this is including the difference we saw before, but also this includes, I'm applying a correction for the calibrations, and the playback is using the standard channel intervals. So we could put the calibrated data into the playback and then you'll get better agreement. But you can really see the difference. And what I want to do is compare the FSSP to the King probe, liquid water.
And it's going to be a lot better. This is going in the right direction. But yeah, this looks good.
So
I'm glad you have this in. But now I'm disappointed you could have easily put you had it right there, the wire probe.
The problem with the wire probe is the offset.
Yeah, but
I did plot it up, but this one agrees a lot better with the wire probe. The questions I have with the wire probe is I need processing. I like to take a zero baseline I have code that will zero that, take and adjust the baseline. So it's zero when you're out of crowd. And the other question I have for, this is not a King probe, it's the DMT hot wire probe. And I don't know what the size interval that it measures over. Is it, we'll get particles larger than 50 microns, and how many of them, where that far off is. And I'm not sure, I don't think we can answer that question, but.
That's not a big deal here right now.
Well, if we go on precip.
It's not a factor for this comparison.
No, it's not a factor. But we should, the FSSP should be at or below the King probe. And so hopefully what we'll see is that sometimes they match, and if sometimes the King probe's a little higher, then we can say that they're sensing larger droplets. But, and if you want, all the data is there. You can process it. It's just the problem with taking that offset to do it. So next talk for Terry.
Well, my comment is my experience, and the reason I was frustrated because you left that day. I got the corrected tables, and then I plotted the two, and I got that scatter.
Yeah.
And my comment is, a bad calibration is worse than no calibration at all.
All right.
And we have run into this in the past. I'm doing a calibration under bad circumstances and maybe with the not the right tools and environment can be disastrous. But what I like about your method is you don't change anything.
Nope.
It's all in post-processing, because I've had experiences where you send stuff in and they made changes and we should have never changed anything.
No.
You know? So that's why I was very frustrated when you had done, I got the post-processing and I got this scatter and I compared it to the liquid water and it was all over the map. And my fear was that something was wrong. Either the beads are lumping together or they're using the wrong method and the error, like if you use a high pressure gun under some conditions, you actually get water drops. Like it's compressed, like, you know, just an air gun sometimes in your hand leaves a wet spot. If it cools the air so much, it condenses
yeah.
it. And you get drops around. I was imagining a lot of bad things.
Yeah.
Well,
so I'm glad it was just a simple.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the other thing that I would say is bad processing is worse than no processing also. So it's not just the calibration that could be bad, it's the processing.
We found something in there.
Yeah. And the other thing is, going back to Terry's comment, is, you know, I like to calibrate the probe at the beginning of the project, or and also ideally done in the lab at DMT or at WMI before the project in good conditions. You keep that and you use that for the whole project. And all these are just checks to make sure that it's still working. You don't apply these to the data. These are just checks to make sure that the instrument's working.
And
sorry, does that mean we should be doing more calibration checks to see the trend the instruments are using its accuracy in line?
It's not a trend. You won't see a trend. What you want to detect is, like, this instrument is not working. You want to know when it goes from working to not working. Okay? And this one's been consistent. So if someone comes along and says, you know, we want to, you know, we think there's something up with your instrument, that we got different data in April, it looks funny. Well, you can go back at this and say, no, the instrument has been behaving the same. You know?
One thing, though, one of those examples, first thing I did was look at the date. You said, see, 4.1 to 3.9, it's good, it doesn't change much, it could be a trend. They were done on the same date. Those are just two little different periods. So that shows you, Victor's point, that's within the noise of two calibrations.
Yep.
Terry, do the beads, if you leave them in the testing jar for long after they begin? naturally to,
yeah.
to group.
They so can they, opening up, we call it contamination, humidity, moisture, whatever, age, I don't know, poor handling, I don't you know, stuff that's, they can age.
Are we measuring specific amounts of beads each time?
No, it doesn't matter the amount, but the other thing we've done is when we started this, they actually have an expiration date on these. They have a purchase date and an expiration date. So one thing that we did was we compared the ones that were like 5 years old to brand new ones that I got to see if there's any difference. And so far, I couldn't tell any difference. So I don't think there's not like a two-channel difference. But we do have brand new beads for the project, and we're using them. But please don't put water, and be very careful what you do with these. The other reason to do this is, like Terry says, if you do enough of these, then you can go back and see what the variation is and come up with an uncertainty measurement of what the natural uncertainty of this is. And if you get a record, then you'll know, oh, is this just in random noise of the calibration, or is this really a fundamental change in the instrument? So we're kind of coming up with that data set that, you know, if you put in 15 micron beads, what's the variability that you should see?
The one thing, Dave, I have to tell you, I didn't realize the difference was that great between the water equivalent and the bead size.
Yep.
Because I must admit, if I was putting in 30 micron beads, I was looking for the peak in the 30 micron channel.
No.
It's 24. That's significant. But let's go back to your B scattering curve, just so that. Now, channel one, what is your channel one?
With my correction is 5 to 8 microns.
You don't even go into
with the beads. They're off by a whole channel. So it shifts everything.
Just of the probe.
Of the probe, it's 3 to normally the standard sizes are 3 to 5, 5 to 7, 5 to 7 to 9.
Go on your log scale.
So
3 to 5. Now go up and just pick a power level. What do you think it is?
Same.
10 to minus 6.
No, but it's the lowest of the curve. I would pick it low just to get the small ones. And I think that's what it does. Do you understand? Pick it here. This is the water. No, glass. Even pick it here.
No.
So you get 1, 2, 3, 4, so 5. Then the next one, you're probably even going to be here. Now, this is, what's the next one? Sorry, 5 to 7?
5 to 7.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There, you've got that peak.
Yeah.
And from then on, maybe the first three channels.
You can do that. That's one of the advantages.
And then show a distribution in real life, and you'll see that.
Yeah.
In real world.
Yeah, that's one thing you can do with the SPP. Is you can actually set where you want them channels to be, where on the old one you couldn't. So you could do what you want and set them so
And the other thing is that CCM, they're a tenth of a micron, and you're going to get drops that are about a micron. But even in the cloud chamber, which is centimeters thick, as the droplets grow quickly, you know, the small ones grow fastest.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, even at a few thousand feet above cloud base, you're getting a distribution similar to your cow. A few in the small, and that's the catch-all bins. Those are for the small ones. And it's okay, that's my point.
Yeah. No, it's a great
probe.
Great probe, so, I mean, don't worry, like Terry says, don't worry too much about this, but just be aware that it's there. I shouldn't berate the point. But again, that's why it becomes, that's why people say don't use this as an aerosol probe to try to measure things from 5 to 8 micron, or 0.5 to 8 microns, because it's going to be terrible.
Excuse me.
Well, not terrible. It's going to be more difficult, yes.
What about if we have standard measurements to compare it always with this standard measurements?
Yeah, that's what the grass beads are. The grass beads are a standard. Because they're one size, they've been sized to be that.
Different. Size.
Different.
The size, we talk about the size of the atmosphere. We cannot get any standards for the atmosphere.
These grass beads are 20 micron size.
Yeah.
They're all that size. So that's the standard.
Standard.
Yeah.
Is different
for the water?
Yeah.
The water equivalent is just doing the adjustment for the fact that it scatters differently. But yeah, this is developed. I mean, you could, if you wanted to, in the lab, you could generate water droplets and calibrate against them. But it's very difficult to do that, to generate a water droplet of a standard size. Okay? So, and this theory to go between the grass beads and the water is very well established. I mean, this scattering theory is behind so much instrumentation. It's used all over the place. They got many, many courses at universities just talking about this scattering theory. It's very, so there's no uncertainty to worrying about the fact of using grass beads as opposed to water. If you do it and apply it correctly, it's not a problem.
Dave, you were using total concentrations in comparison. What percentage of bin 1 that you say, if you go back to your scattering, what percentage of bin 1 makes up the total counts that you're comparing? Because if you have size assignments in one and you've got that outer phase between glass and water, I mean, that's quite a massive difference in.
No, the most
power scattering.
Particles. Oh, sorry. Go back here. If you got total concentrations, if you got 1,000 particles, let's see, you can look at the data. I saw some numbers like, there would be 700 in bin 1. 750 in bin 2, 800 in bin 3, that's where it would peak, and it would go down to 700 in bin 4. So next time I'll show you the distribution. But for liquid water, the larger particles dominate, because you got that. But you could see how much. So,
I'm just curious, if your bin assignments includes up to 10, if you go back to your me scattering graph, and you're calibrating it on glass beads that have, I think it was a low, one more hit, around about 10 microns there, you see how it's out of phase. Now, if you're getting massive counts of your peak in your calibration of glass, then you're getting higher counts of water, is that not going to make a massive difference to your total concentrations? If you've calibrated bin 1 to detect higher with for water than you have with the glass beads. I just want to know what percentage of them will actually make a difference to the total counts that you see when you compare and you get your slope.
I'm trying to understand the question.
Well, your bin 1 was 5 to 7, is that right?
Yeah.
Now, I'm just wondering if maybe the fact that it's out of phase and that bin assignment in bin 1, you calibrated it to scale on your graph as well.
This comparison has nothing to do with sizes, just as it's counts. So if it sticks it in the wrong bin, it doesn't matter because I summed them all up. So.
And this actually can be explained.
This is a sample ball.
This is in the right direction. This regarding activity, dead time, coincidence loss.
But. So it's.
Can be standard.
And what?
It can be a standard.
Or, it can be explained and corrected.
Yeah. So.
and then compare it with the wire. Right. And I think my comparison was the FSP was way, was too low.
Yes.
So going in the right direction.
Yeah, so this one, if you run it through this connection and compare it to hot wire, it's pretty, from my first look at the data, it was pretty reasonable. But I need to do a detailed analysis. And so that's what I promised. If you want to write it on your calendar, I do a talk on the cloud liquid water measurement on the 23rd. So stay tuned for the next one.
Yes. Oh, we're slowly getting...
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I'll get a copy.
Okay, you need a copy.